Good afternoon. So the title of this talk, the title of yesterday's talk, you could say, was The Motive. The title of today's talk is called The Working Basis, Our Precious Human Life. So yesterday we heard a little bit about Gampopa, and we also heard something about his great work, The Dual Ornament of Liberation in general. And more specifically, we heard about the first chapter of that work. We heard about Gampopa's vision of reality, the Buddha's vision of reality. We heard something about samsara, the state of bewilderment and confusion and suffering. And we heard about the end of all bewilderment and suffering, liberation, nirvana. And at the very end of the talk, we had a look at what's called Tathagatagarbha, the seed of enlightenment, which is the primary cause, the motive for liberation, which, according to Gampopa, we all have, we all possess, and which also Gampopa makes very, very clear, makes it clear throughout the Dual Ornament of Liberation, that liberation from suffering, enlightenment, only comes about through effort and hard work. I'll keep saying that throughout this series. Just in case, you know, it can happen with when people hear about Tathagatagarbha, they think, oh yeah, but I've got the potential. I've got the potential. I remember once somebody was saying to Sangharakshita, talking about somebody, said, well, he's got incredible, wonderful potential, Bhante. That's what you call a venerable Buddhist. And Bhante said, yes, well, we're all told that we've got Buddha nature, but it's useless unless it manifests. So you're going to be hearing a lot about hard work. So we heard about that we have to live from our spiritual potential, we have to activate our spiritual potential, and we need to keep it activated. The ore has to be worked to extract the silver. The milk has to be churned for there to be butter. In the same way, we have to work on ourselves. We have to live from what is deepest within us, from what is most noble within us, in order to transform our entire being so that we may be a Buddha. This begins, says Gampopa, by recognizing that we possess the working basis for the attainment of enlightenment. And that working basis, says Gampopa, is the most precious human body, the most precious human life, human existence itself. This is the working basis for our spiritual path, for the path to liberation. And this is, I think, very striking in itself. Gampopa doesn't begin his exploration of the path to enlightenment with discussions about morality or meditation. He doesn't get into the metaphysics of Buddha nature. He directs our attention to something so familiar to us, so that we're so intimate with, if you like, that it would be very easy to miss, very easy to take for granted. He directs our attention to our humanness. For Gampopa, for Buddhist tradition generally, being a human being is regarded as a tremendous achievement in itself. It's regarded as a tremendous achievement in itself. Being a human being in Buddhist tradition is regarded as something extraordinary, extraordinarily precious and valuable, and something not to be squandered and wasted by living a meaningless life. In fact, we need to reflect even whether we are indeed truly human. We assume that we're human. We have a human body, it works reasonably well. We have a human consciousness that works reasonably well. We socialise more or less well enough with other human beings. But is that really enough? Is that enough to constitute the working basis for the attainment of enlightenment? Is our humanity actually complete? So to make sure, Gampopa in a way sort of defines what he means by being human. By being human in the sense of having a working basis for enlightenment. So he says a human being who is a working basis for the attainment of enlightenment, must possess three things. First of all, he must possess freedom, in the sense of being free from eight unfavourable circumstances. Secondly, we must possess endowments, assets, riches, five external endowments and five internal endowments. And thirdly, a human being who is the working basis for enlightenment must possess three kinds of faith or three kinds of confidence. So I'm going to explore these three areas. We'll look at them to sort of measure ourselves. What sort of human being are we? And we'll also see why the kind of being human being Gampopa is evoking is indeed the working basis for the attainment of enlightenment. So first of all, the eight freedoms. To explain these freedoms, Gampopa quotes from an ancient Buddhist text. He does this throughout the work, as I think I've already said, quotes a lot from ancient Buddhist texts. And this text goes like this. Denizens of hell, hungry ghosts, animals, long-living gods, members of the border tribes, those with wrong views, and those born where there is no Buddha, and those with severe impediments to understanding, these represent the unfavourable conditions. So these are the unfavourable conditions that we need to be free from. So let's look at these. But before doing that, one very important point. We reflect on our freedom from unfavourable conditions, not to look down on others and not to feed our conceit. We do this, in fact, for the exact opposite. We do this to recognise what we have, what freedom we have. We have the freedom to lead a spiritual life because we're not in these other circumstances. So it's not an exercise in complacency. Quite the opposite. So the first four unfavourable conditions are the beings of the other realms of the Wheel of Life. The Wheel of Life is a classic Buddhist symbol, a very important Buddhist symbol. It's a sort of picture of samsara, a picture of suffering and bewilderment. And if you go to any Tibetan monastery outside the meditation room, you'll find in the kind of vestibule to the main shrine a great big picture of the Wheel of Life to remind you of what you're leaving. We've got a sort of modern version of it in the doorway into the sort of lounge area as you come in from outside. There's a small painting by Arloka of a sort of modern version of the Wheel of Life. So let me just describe these different realms. First of all, there's the world of hell, and the picture in the Wheel of Life will be a state of terrible torture, people burning and being tortured, or being frozen in the cold hells. It's a state of uninterrupted and unbearable suffering, and the beings who are born in this realm are said to be there because they've committed very, very evil and unskillful deeds, particularly deeds of hatred. That's how they've arrived there. Then you get the state of the hungry ghosts, and this is a state of uninterrupted, unfulfilled craving. These ghosts have huge bellies, big heads, and tiny pin-shaped mouths, and huge saucer-like eyes. And they wander in sort of deserts. And when they come across food or water, they go to take it because they're so hungry and thirsty, and it turns into fire or excrement. Or if they can get it into their little mouths, it kind of turns to thorns in their throat and glass and things like that. So it's a state of unfulfilled craving, this unbearable suffering of unfulfilled craving. Then you have the state of the animals depicted, and obviously we're very familiar with the realm of the animals. You see animals mating, hunting, eating, sleeping, and so on. enslavement to men. You have depicted the realm of the gods, and these are always depicted as very beautiful realms, where these ethereal beings are enjoying all sorts of pleasures, listening to music, absorbed in contemplation. They're all really beautiful beings, androgynous beings, just enjoying permanent, seemingly, though it's not really, bliss. You sometimes as well get depicted in this god realm the Asuras. These are the sort of jealous gods, and they're sometimes regarded as another kind of god, and they are always fighting. They're highly competitive, and they're always fighting, always competing with the other gods. So these are the different realms into which, according to traditional Buddhism, we can be reborn, depending on the way we live now. This all happens within the context of the law of karma, which I'll be talking about in a few days' time. They don't happen by chance. It depends very much on the states of mind, the motives, the states of mind that with which you perform various actions in this life. That's how you end up in these ways, in these worlds. That's the traditional way of looking at these six realms. I think it's actually very hard for us to relate to the six realms as actual realms out there. People find that very difficult. It's sort of existing in space, so to speak. So we can look at them as states which we can actually occupy ourselves. And of course, when we look around the human realm, we can see people in these states, and we've probably experienced these states. So hell is a state of extreme and constant suffering, especially mental suffering. It's a state of, you know, severe mental illness, of extreme paranoia, where everything and everybody is just seen as threatening and oppressive. It's a state of extreme fear, overwhelming fear. Everything is antagonistic towards you. It's that state of mental torture, if you like. The hungry ghost state is a state of just overwhelming craving. You just feel empty all the time. You just feel this kind of ennui, this terrible sort of boredom and inner emptiness. You feel as though you do have that huge empty belly, and you're always trying to fill it. You're trying to fill it neurotically, you know, through eating obsessively, or, you know, having sex obsessively, or trying to get attention obsessively. You might even use religion in that way. You might even use Buddhism in that way to just try and fill that inner emptiness. But it just makes you feel more empty. That craving is never fulfilled. You're in this kind of ghost-like state drifting along. And yes, sometimes we can even be like animals. This means that we have really no higher life. There's no reflection on deeper meaning. We're just living at a very basic survival level. We're living to eat, copulate, survive, head down in the trough. Sometimes we're even like a god. We feel happy, content. We enjoy life. Everything is smooth. Everything seems to come to us like the fruits of the wish-fulfilling tree. So there's no need to kind of, you know, do anything particularly with your life, because life is groovy, life is great, life is happy. Sometimes we're like a jealous god as well, you know, involved in competitive games of various kinds. So if we're in any of these states, if we're in any of these states to an extreme, it's going to be almost impossible to practice the Dharma. So we won't have a real working basis if we're in these states. If we're in hell, if we're overwhelmed by suffering, so overwhelmed by suffering and pain, well, we're not going to be turning our minds to anything beyond that. So if we have the misfortune to be in a state of extreme suffering, you just have to find relief. It might be good just to forget about Buddhism if you're in a state of extreme, overwhelming suffering. Just find some respite, some space from the pain. Get yourself some ease. Get yourself, you know, just treat that suffering somehow. If you're like a hungry ghost, Again, it's very unlikely when we're in that state of extreme craving, very unlikely that we'll find any space for Buddhist practice. If we do go to Buddhism, we'll be trying to get something to fill our craving. Again, you sort of distort Buddhism, and it can't really help you when you approach it in that state. I've seen this many times, people trying to fill their vast inner emptiness with Buddhist ideas, with Buddhists, if you like. And it just doesn't work. So if we're in that state of craving, we need to find out, what do I really need? What do I really need to do to deal with this state? Otherwise, we're just going to drift on forever like a ghost. If we're in that animal-like state, well, there won't be any interest in living a spiritual life. We're just too coarse. We're just living to survive. A lot of human beings seem more and more to be kind of living in this way. I mean, it's travel to work, work, and then exhaustion at the end of the day. There's no room for anything else. So if we're in that kind of state, if we're living that sort of, you know, rather drudge-like existence, we need to create a human space for things to happen. We need to kind of create a human space of culture and friendship and human communication and opportunity for reflection. That needs to be there in order to follow a spiritual life. And sometimes we are like a kind of God. Everything is going very well. We've got no worries. We're happy. We're content. Maybe that's even the result of the spiritual practice that we've done. Maybe we've just kind of been born like that. Sometimes some people seem to be kind of have that kind of magic touch. You know, everything seems to come to them. They're good looking. They seem to be able, they're talented. They earn good money. They, you know, get the girls or the boys or whatever it is. Everything is very easy and smooth. I think actually in the West, in many ways, there are a lot of gods. There's so much sort of privilege. This can be disputed in the study groups, of course, but there's so much privilege, so many things you can do with the world. Maybe we just don't think about the spiritual life seriously. Things are so good, we get complacent. We don't work at ourselves, and we can be insensitive to other people. The gods can be very insensitive to others, to human suffering. So we need to become human. If we're in that godlike state, we need to recognise, well, this is not permanent. This isn't going to last forever. Things will change. Things do change. This won't go on forever. So in these states, we're overwhelmed either by suffering or craving or ignorance, overwhelmed even by happiness. So much so, there's no space, there's no room for reflection. There's no room, therefore, to reflect on the way things are. There's no room to reflect on the Dharma, to practice the Dharma. Tsongkhapa says, it's only here and now, in this slight suffering of the human state, that we find what is valuable for spiritual development. It's only here and now, in this slight suffering of the human state, that we find what is valuable for spiritual development. I think this is a very interesting comment. In the human state, there is some experience, some awareness of suffering. We all know this. But it doesn't overwhelm us. It doesn't oppress us so much as it does in those, as it can do in those other realms. Well, neither are we kind of overwhelmed by happiness. So we've got, in the human state, the truly human state, we can reflect upon things. The human state is a state free from extremes. Yeah, the human state is a state free from extremes. So when we encounter suffering, it makes us think. It makes us think deeply. The etymology of the word for suffering in Pali is and Sanskrit is the word is dukkha. And the etymology means something like the faulty chariot wheel. The faulty chariot wheel. This is what suffering is. We're going along in our chariot, and if we've got a faulty wheel, it's a bumpy, uncomfortable ride. So that means we want to sort it out. We want to get off the chariot, and we don't put up with it. We want to fix the wheel. So it's like that in the human state. The human state is becoming aware that we've got a faulty wheel, a faulty chariot wheel. So because of the slight suffering of the human state, Gampopa says, we become discontented with samsara. We develop compassion for others. Our pride is curbed. We turn away from unwholesome activities. And we develop the good and the wholesome. Very interesting verse this. So the suffering we experience in the human state makes us reflect, makes us look at ourselves, look at life much more deeply. We see it for what it is. We see it as samsara. And we start to look for a radical solution. The suffering of the human realm also gives us the opportunity to develop love and compassion. This is why the gods have problems with spiritual development, because they don't see any suffering. But in the human realm, we're presented with suffering. We see it around us. And that gives us the opportunity to develop love and compassion. And there is no spiritual development without love and compassion. It's not possible to develop spiritually without developing love and compassion. Suffering also curbs pride and conceit. A very interesting connection being made there. Well worth reflecting on. Perhaps, when we're younger, we can be very kind of intoxicated with life. In a way, it's a lovely thing to see. But there's a kind of conceit that grows with that. Because, in a way, we haven't suffered very much. Or we haven't noticed suffering very much. So, freedom from being in hell, being a hungry ghost, being an animal or a god, means that we're free from extremes of suffering and bliss. So we've got an opportunity, we've got the space in which to work. There are three more freedoms to mention. First of all, there's freedom from extreme wrong views. By wrong view, Gampopa doesn't mean simply some dodgy ideas about life, just a little bit of poor philosophy, if you like. He means freedom from extreme, strongly held, dogmatic stances on life. For example, extreme religious or political fundamentalisms, the kind of dogma that promotes the killing of non-believers, the kind of dogma that creates untouchability in India, for example. Or that regards those who don't share your views as non-persons, expendable people. These extreme views, if you hold these extreme views, you don't really have the working basis for spiritual life. If you have views like that, the spiritual life in the Buddhist sense is impossible. It's impossible while you hold views like that. Extreme materialistic views would come in here as well, which materialistic views that reduce man simply to his physicality, to his biology and chemistry, and that there is nothing higher or deeper in human life. I think a lot of people have difficulties with spiritual life, especially meditation, because of actually deeply held and unanalyzed materialistic views on life. That they don't have a sense of the power and the richness and the centrality of mind and consciousness. You know, mind and consciousness is a sort of blip as part of our physics and biology. And that's why they have a lot of difficulty in making spiritual progress. So extreme wrong views, we need to be free of them. We need to sort them out if we have them. Another freedom is being free from being born in a region where there is no Buddha. For Gampopa, for traditional Buddhists, you would have to be an extraordinary person to follow the Buddhist path if you did not encounter the Buddha and his teaching. So to be born in a time when the Buddha has taught is regarded as extraordinarily important. I'll say more about that a bit later on. The last of the unfavourable conditions is being free from severe impediments to understanding. I think it's obvious what this means. We might be human, but things just don't work properly in one way or another, so we cannot learn. We cannot think, we cannot reflect. I don't want to sort of dwell on this very much. I must stress here, this isn't mentioned in order to look down on others. It's mentioned so that we understand, that we appreciate and value the freedoms that we actually have. So these freedoms are regarded as a unique occasion. A unique occasion. This is a translation of a Tibetan word which has its root in the Sanskrit kshana, kshana. And kshana means not just a unique occasion, it means the present moment. And this is the point. Right now, we are free from all kinds of unfavourable circumstances. We are human beings. So right now, this moment, this life, is the time, the only time, to make the most of ourselves. There is no other time. There is no other moment. As human beings, we have a mind, a consciousness that's remarkable, that it can reflect, it can extrapolate from its immediate sense experience. This means that we can, very positively, make comparison with ourselves and others. It's the basis for Buddhist ethics. It's the basis, if you like, for having the notion even of enlightenment. It can range over time, as it were. We're not so sort of locked into sense experience. This kind of mind is of very great value because we can discriminate, we can make sense of things, we can reflect on what's valuable. But it also has its downside. It means that we can put things off, we can defer, we can fantasize. I'll do it later. I'll practice Buddhism later. I'll really do something with my life when. When? That's the way we think, don't we? I'll get down to it in the new year when I make my New Year's resolution. But right now, in fact, is the only time. This life, this moment, this is the freedom that we have. What we do now is the most important thing. Dogen, the great Zen master, Japanese Zen master Dogen says, you are only alive right now. You don't know anything about the future, actually. You are only alive right now. So this moment, this human life, this human existence is the precious opportunity. Right now, on this retreat, we have the freedom to practice Dharma. So let's turn, having said all that, to the 10 endowments for a precious human life. We've looked at what we can be free from, but let's look at these 10 endowments that form this working basis. Some of these are simply the positive aspect of the freedoms already mentioned. And these 10 are divided into two groups. The first 5 are more personal achievements, and the second 5 are concerned with others, with external conditions. I think I might have said before, but I'll just remind you, Gampopa's text is full of these divisions and subdivisions. Many Buddhist texts are actually like this, and Gampopa's is especially like this. Someone said it's a bit like a manual from an IKEA product, you know, where about how you put a cupboard together. It was Miles that said that, and I think he's right, actually. It can be a bit irritating in some ways, because it's not like reading, a piece of literature in that sense. But we have to remember that the text is a manual for spiritual practice, a manual for liberation. How you put together... You know, it's the IKEA guide to enlightenment. No, so it's not. And all these divisions and subheadings are really aids to contemplation. That's what Gampopa wants us to do with all these things. He wants us to go away and think and reflect and apply these things to our experience. So, first of all, these of the endowments, the riches, are the 5 personal achievements. So, first of all, to be human. So we've explored this already. We've got the basic human kit, so to speak. That's an achievement. Don't take that for granted. Secondly, to be born in the central country. Actually, the central country, the Madhya Desha, refers to India, and more particularly where the Buddha taught and Buddhism flourished. Ironically, when Gampopa composed the Jewel of Liberation, Buddhism was actually kind of on its way out in the central country, in India. And you'll find even, you know, modern Tibetan Buddhists, they talk about the central country. They still use that old Buddhist terminology. What the central country means is that you're born in a place where Buddhism, where the Dharma, is flourishing. You have the facilities, in other words, to actually practice Buddhism. There are centres you can go to, there are retreat centres you can go to, there's a flourishing sangha of practicing Buddhists, there are texts available to you. And you actually have the freedom to practice. You're not born somewhere where you're persecuted for being a Buddhist. So it's regarded traditionally as a great personal achievement to be born in a place where it's possible to practice the Dharma, where it's possible to practice Buddhism. I think this is well worth reflecting on. We live in a world and an age, in the West certainly, there's so much emphasis on what we lack. There's so much emphasis on what we lack, on what's wrong. You know, there was that famous book by Robert Hughes, The Culture of Complaint. The Culture of Complaint. And it's probably even worse since Robert Hughes wrote his book, The Culture of Complaint. It's actually shameful, the sort of complaining that goes on. You know, things go a bit wrong with the weather, and there's a complaint about, you know, travel facilities. Hey, it's the weather, people. Compared with other parts of the world, our conditions are incredibly favourable for spiritual practice, actually. Incredibly conducive. I mean, it's remarkable, actually, that you can come here for a week, 2 weeks, to a place dedicated to Buddhist practice. That's remarkable in this world. It's a remarkable achievement to be able to be free to do this. There's some parts of the world. I was hearing about a Buddhist from Iran who came to one of our centres, a Buddhist in Iran. And, you know, he's involved in a little Buddhist group. But of course, you know, everything has to be hidden away. It all has to happen in basements and, you know, Buddhist books kind of circulate on an underground system and things like that. It's all very, you know, it sounds all very romantic and we all like the idea of it. You know, oh yeah, you know, a kind of underground Buddhist, but, you know, it would be really very, very difficult indeed. So it's remarkable that we have the opportunity to engage in the facilities for Buddhist practice, and we live in a world where we're free to follow our conscience. The third endowment, the third of the personal achievement, is to possess all faculties. You have, you know, the basic human kit. You can understand the Dharma. You can think, you can reflect, you can distinguish between right and wrong. You can make that sort of distinction. Everything works. Works well enough to practice. We've all got our little quirks, haven't we? But it all works well enough to practice the Dharma. Fourthly, you have the confidence. You have confidence in the spiritual discipline taught by the Buddha. So you have confidence in the basic disciplines of Buddhist practice. I'll say more about this later on, what this means. Fifthly, the fifth personal endowment is that you haven't committed any of the five worst possible actions. This is a very traditional list. The five offenses. These are harming a Buddha. It's a terrible thing to do. You can't kill a Buddha, apparently. But you can harm them. Well, that's a terrible thing if you harm a Buddha. Killing an arhat, that's an enlightened being who comes after the Buddha, that's a terrible thing to do. Killing your father, killing your mother, well, they're pretty terrible, aren't they? And causing a split in the Sangha, in the spiritual community of followers of the Buddha. These are the worst possible actions. So you haven't done any of those. Well, that's an achievement. That means that you're free to practice. the effects, the karmic effects of these things are very, very heavy. They're really going to burden you. Of course, there are other very serious things too. And some people, when they come to Buddhism, they've sometimes had a bit of a past. And we know that the effects of that can linger on, maybe for a long time. There can be quite a heavy load that we feel that we're carrying. And that needs purifying through engaging in spiritual practice. And purification is possible. Here, though, we're reflecting what's going on here with this particular endowment, personal endowment, is that we're reflecting, well, actually, I haven't done anything grossly unethical in my life. I haven't killed somebody. I haven't done something really very serious. I have a basic goodness. I'm basically a good man, a good person. Well, that's an achievement. That's not to be taken for granted. And we need to notice this. We need to notice our basic goodness. Some people are really burdened and overwhelmed by irrational guilt. Meet people like this. They're really sort of, you know, they think they're a bad person. And you ask them, you know, have you killed somebody? No. You know, have you, you know, been a bank robber? Well, no. And you kind of get into it and you think, well, actually, this person's actually a good person. But for some reason, some idea, no doubt to do with their childhood, past lives, who knows? They've got this idea. They're carrying this weight of guilt. They just think very badly of themselves. Well, that's a real impediment to practice. But they've never actually been that bad. So we need to reflect much more on our basic goodness, on that we're a good person. We're a basic good bloke. There's a lot of emphasis in Buddhist tradition placed on being free from guilt. It's said, you know, if you're weighed down by guilt, it's going to be very hard for you in meditation. You'll feel really shackled and burdened in meditation. And they recommend a lot of puja, a lot of chanting, a lot of making of offerings to relieve you of that burden of guilt. So reflect if you suffer from these feelings of guilt. Well, really ask yourself, well, is it actually true? Or is this just some idea I've got about myself that I've learned, well, who knows what from? Of course, if there are things that you've done that you feel are, you know, objectively you've been unskillful with, well, it's important to talk about those with a spiritual friend and unburden yourself, even confess them. So that's the five personal endowments, and then there are endowments that are associated with others. So these are very positive. So reflecting, we reflect that the Buddha has arisen in this world. Someone did gain enlightenment. Somebody did attain wisdom and compassion and liberation. And they're an example to us. They're an embodiment of what we can be. This is a source of tremendous inspiration to us. And we not only that, we feel a resonance with that. It's not just an idea. We feel a resonance with the enlightened Buddha, with wisdom and compassion. That's uplifting. Secondly, the Dharma has been taught. So not only has the Buddha gained enlightenment, he's taught a very clear path of spiritual practice and training, clearly laid out, a very rich path with all sorts of methods and disciplines and practices that we can relate to, that we can use. That's a very wonderful thing, that there's a clear path. Thirdly, the teachings of the Dharma are still alive. They're still extant. The Dharma is available. It's around, and there's actually rather a lot of it. It's not an antique, exotic, Eastern thing. It's alive right now in 21st century Britain. So it's available. We can make use of it. Fourthly, there are people who keep the teachings alive. There's the Sangha, the spiritual community, the followers of the Buddha, who keep the Dharma alive. They keep it alive through their study, their meditation, their conduct. They keep it alive through providing places in which Buddhist practice can flourish, environments which we can go to if we want to. They practice the Dharma as men and women of their time and their place. So they keep the Dharma alive right now. We can, that's available to us if we want it. And fifthly, there exist people who support us with love and compassion. So we can be part of that Sangha if we wish. And they will, that Sangha will support us in our spiritual practice through teaching, inspiration and challenge if necessary. So with the second of the five endowments, Gampopa is asking us to reflect on the Buddha, the Enlightened One, the Dharma, his teaching and the Sangha, the followers of the Buddha, and how they're actually available to us. They are there. Again, not to make us think how great we are because we're in this Buddhist group and other people aren't. It's not meant in that way, but so that we can see what riches we actually possess, what's actually available to us, so that we don't take what we have for granted. And so that we will use what we have as a working basis to attain liberation. That's the point of these reflections. So these endowments are also called the right juncture, the coming together of the best conditions. It's a very important point here. Buddhist life, Buddhist practice is sustained and maintained by conditions. It doesn't happen just by itself. Liberation, happiness, doesn't happen just by itself. The acquisition, the attainment of meaning and spiritual growth doesn't just happen by itself. It doesn't just happen because you will it to happen. You can't just sort of think it into existence, liberation. Liberation arises out of conditions, primarily internal conditions. We need to be intensely motivated. We need to work at our spiritual life, but we also need external conditions to support and sustain and magnify and amplify our motivation. And especially important here is the Sangha, spiritual friends, getting together with them to practice the Dharma together, to study the Dharma together, to interact with one another. I meet old friends sometimes, order members and mitras. Maybe they're people that I've ordained or they regard me as their spiritual friend in some way. And sometimes they tell me how difficult everything's been for them, how they feel they kind of lost their way. And so I'll say, well, you know, are you meditating? No. Are you going on retreat? No. Are you studying? No. Do you meet up with your spiritual friends? No. I often say, well, you know, nicely, it's not a question of ticking people off. So, well, you know, what do you expect? You know, I mean, you know, you are going to lose your way if you don't engage in those conditions. I mean, spiritual life is sustained by conditions. It's only when you're a stream entrant, when you've become irreversible from enlightenment, that spiritual life just happens spontaneously. You know, when that awareness of reality is always constantly present, well, you don't have to bother so much about conditions, though you'll probably be using them for the benefit of others. So liberation doesn't just happen by itself. You need to apply yourself to conditions and keep setting them up and putting yourself into them to sustain and maintain your practice. The seed of Buddhahood needs the soil, the sunlight, the rain, of positive and supportive conditions in which to flourish. So what all this discussion of the endowments and freedoms amounts to is really very simple. It's really about making the most of our humanity, cherishing our humanity, our humanness, recognizing its value and using it, using all our powers to uncover what is most meaningful. I said at the beginning of this retreat, but I'll repeat it, that I don't really mind if by the end of a retreat people are, you know, still more deeply Buddhist or they're convinced by Buddhism if they're just trying it out. That doesn't really bother me, really. What I really want a retreat to do is for people to recognise the value and the preciousness of their human life, of their human existence, so that they'll use that in the most meaningful way possible, in a really creative and deeply satisfying way, that they live really very, very fully and give full expression to their humanity. What a shame it would be if we came to the end of our days and we felt nothing but regret for wasting our lives, for wasting our time, for wasting our humanity. What a shame it would be if we ended up with that regret. Gampopa tells us that the word for man in Sanskrit is Purusha, which etymologically means to have power or ability. So as human beings, he says, we have great power and ability, and we can use that power and ability to transform ourselves into Buddhas. And Gampopa quotes an ancient teacher named Chandragomin, an Indian teacher, who says, who can deprive of his fruit a man who, having obtained a human life, who sows the good and the wholesome, the seeds of excellent enlightenment? If you do sow such seeds, no one can take away the fruits that you will enjoy. If you really sow the seeds and make the most of your human life, whatever you gain cannot be taken away. This is something worth reflecting on, something Sangharakshita, the founder of our order, used to say. He used to say that actually you're a much safer ground following a spiritual life than devoting yourself to a worldly life. He said, because the fruits of the spiritual life are actually guaranteed. If you keep up practicing skillfully, if you keep generating skillful states, you keep meditating, following ethics, living in that way, those fruits will come. But with a worldly life, you're not just relying on your own ambition, your own talent. There are all sorts of other conditions and forces that are outside of your control that could go very wrong and could destroy your efforts. So nobody can deprive you of the fruits of leading a spiritual life, of making the most of your human, precious human life. So we need to use our precious human life. We need to make the most of it. And Gampopa places much stress on its fragility. This human life is easily lost, and we don't know when we'll have the opportunity to practice again. He likens, in fact, the human body to a boat that we use to cross the ocean of suffering. He likens the human body to a thoroughbred horse. Using it, we can gallop away from suffering and bewilderment. He likens the human body to a servant, serving our higher aims. So already this discussion of what it means to be human, what it means to have a working basis, has covered a lot of ground. But Gampopa has even more to say. After his discussions of the freedoms and endowments, he comes to the third general category that is essential to the working basis, human life. For there to be a working basis for the attainment of liberation, for an effective spiritual practice, we need to awaken the most basic of all spiritual qualities, which, and I'm going to give the Sanskrit here, is called Shraddha. I'm using the word in its original language because it's very hard to translate this into English, Shraddha. It can be translated as faith, very often translated as faith, but that can be misleading. It can be translated as confidence, that can be misleading. It can be translated as trust, that also can be misleading. Or at least these three things don't give the whole picture of what we're talking about. They all say something, but they don't say everything. Shraddha comes from a verbal root meaning to place the heart upon. So it's something deep and central in our being, responding to what is higher and deeper and greater before us, as it were. Sangharakshita describes faith, Shraddha, as the sort of vibration of the Tathagata Gaba, of our Buddha potential, when it encounters the Buddha, when it encounters the enlightenment of the Buddha. Gampopa quotes a text, in fact, which likens Shraddha to a seed. Without Shraddha, no virtues, no qualities grow. And Gampopa gives us a description of what Shraddha is by describing the three kinds of Shraddha. You could also speak of these as the three dimensions of Shraddha. So let's look at these. First of all, there's trusting faith, or trusting Shraddha. And Gampopa says, trusting Shraddha originates when you are convinced by the inevitable relation between karma and its results. And Gampopa goes on to relate that this to the Four Noble Truths. I won't go into that because it's a quite complex discussion. The main point is this. Trusting faith, let's call it that, means that you trust. You're convinced that actions have consequences. Your actions have consequences. You're convinced that your unskillful actions, actions of greed, aversion and delusion and so on, lead to suffering. And you're convinced that skillful actions, actions expressive of contentment and love and awareness and so on, lead to happiness and well-being, not just for yourself, but for others as well. So you're convinced by this, you trust it. So this is the basic Buddhist realization, actually. The realization that your actions have consequences, your motivations have consequences. This is what it means to wake up to being a Buddhist. And it's reflected in the first two verses of the oldest and most popular of Buddhist texts, the Dhammapada, so the word of the Buddha. So you get these verses. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox drawing the cart. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So trusting faith means waking up to this. And of course this is a thrilling moment in your spiritual life when you wake up to the fact that actually it's my mind that creates my world. It's my mind that creates happiness. It's my mind that creates suffering. It's the purity of my mind that creates happiness and meaning and well-being for self and others. It's the impurity of my mind that creates the opposite. It's all in our hands. So this is the basic faith, the basic Shraddha. And without this, really, you'll have no confidence in Buddhist practice. Without this, one won't really have a spiritual life. Without this, perhaps one won't really have a human life. I mentioned yesterday the Venerable Dada Rinpoche, whose relics are in the stupa there. And Dada Rinpoche was a very great Tibetan Lama. He was a great scholar, a great yogi, a great teacher, a great organizer of the Sangha. But he also ran a school for refugee children. That was his great work in Kalimpong in India. And he was asked once, is it your ambition that when your children leave your school that they become Buddhists? And his reply was very interesting. He said, I will be happy if they leave knowing that actions have consequences, that their actions have consequences. So very humanness. So to develop this confidence, we need to just look, we need to see if it's true. We need to just look at ourselves and notice the effects of our actions of body, speech and mind. The second kind of Shraddha that Gampopa mentions is longing faith, longing Shraddha. Gampopa doesn't say much about this. He simply says that it comes from seeing how extraordinarily beautiful enlightenment is. We see its beauty, its wonder, its mystery. It's something incredibly desirable. This is why you have Buddhist art, you know, the wonderful images and paintings of the Buddha and the great masters and the Bodhisattvas. It's why you have Buddhist poetry and Buddhist literature. People have seen the beauty. People are trying to describe the beauty and the fascinating quality of enlightenment. So you long for it. You're eager for this enlightenment. You want it very much. The great Dogen again. It's interesting I keep referring to him. There's obviously resonances between the Tibetan Gampopa and the Japanese Dogen. Dogen says in one place, the most important thing that you need in order to awaken is desire. Desire for the way. It's the most important quality, he says. Supposing, he says, you want to steal a jewel. Well, you'll be very ingenious in order to steal that jewel. You desire that jewel very much. You'll be very ingenious. Or you want to get to know a beautiful woman. You'll be very watchful for the opportunities to get to know her and so on. So, well, you need to bring that energy, that ingenuity, that desire to spiritual practice. So we need this longing faith. And thirdly, there's lucid faith, lucid Shraddha. More fully, this is the Shraddha, the faith, that is a clear, lucid, bright, calm mind and heart. And this comes, it said, when you contemplate the Buddha as the teacher, as your teacher, the Dharma as the path to enlightenment, and the Sangha as the spiritual friends helping you along that path. When you really connect with these, sort of emotionally, it's not just a dry intellectual exercise, but when you connect with these emotionally, these three jewels, as we call them, everything becomes very clear. Everything becomes very clear about what you need to do. There's a serenity that comes with this and a confidence with this. And you feel eager and happy to be leading a spiritual life. Gampopa isn't just content to simply describe these qualities of Shraddha, these three kinds of faith. He also shows us to what pitch this Shraddha needs to be cultivated and developed. The man of true Shraddha, of true faith, what Herbert Günther calls a man with the courage of his convictions, will not give up the Dharma, will not give up spiritual life under any circumstances. He won't give it up out of acquisitiveness, out of hatred, out of fear, or out of delusion. And Gampopa gives examples, tests, if you like, to see whether you've made the Dharma an internal experience. He wants to test and see, well, how deep does my Shraddha, my faith in spiritual life, in spiritual values, goes? So let's look at these. So first of all, not giving up the Dharma out of acquisitiveness. Gampopa says, someone might come along to you and say, I will give you lavish food, wealth, great wealth, women, royalty, power, if you give up Buddhism, if you give up the Dharma. Well, because of your Shraddha, you don't give it up. It probably won't happen to us in this way. It might be very interesting. It'd be very interesting if somebody came in and offered all that to me right now. It'd be very interesting to see what I would do. I've been sort of wondering what our equivalent would be, and I think it's more sort of perhaps moment to moment. You sometimes, you know, see it in communities sometimes. Somebody says, how about meditation and puja tonight? No, I'm a bit tired. What about a film? And suddenly the energy's there. So that's an example of giving up the Dharma out of acquisitiveness. And perhaps this is something that you need to watch out for as you get older, maybe. When we're younger, we can tend to make a lot more effort. We don't mind putting up with discomfort. We perhaps settle down a bit more when we're older. I remember being very struck reading a very good book about the old forest monks in Thailand. This is going back to the early part of the 20th century. And the person writing about this said that a lot of the monks had, you know, they had struggles with celibacy when they were younger, but they overcame them. But the real danger came when they reached their 50s. And that's when a lot of them gave up the robe and got married and settled down, if you like, the attractions of comfort. And they gave up that full-time, rigorous spiritual life. Very interesting. So we need to watch out when we get a bit older. We put comfort before spiritual effort. This is the point really being made here. But if our faith is developed, we don't do this. We focus always on the Dharma. Secondly, not giving up the Dharma out of hatred. There's a very interesting explanation here. Gampopa says, so supposing someone attacks you, abuses you, does you great harm, verbally, physically, and you have the opportunity, you have the means to retaliate in word and deed. You don't do that. And you don't retaliate because if you retaliate, that will mean that you've renounced the Dharma. This is really interesting. Even if somebody's attacking Buddhism, attacking you as a Buddhist, if you retaliate, you've given up the Dharma. It means you don't actually have faith in Buddhism. In that moment, your faith in the Dharma has gone. This is very, very profound, I think. And it's one of the reasons why Buddhism is so demanding as a spiritual tradition. There's never, ever any justification for retaliation, no matter what's being done to you. If you give in to harming others, whatever you're on the end of, you've broken the basic Buddhist precept of non-harm, non-injury, non-violence. I heard an incredible story about a Tibetan monk, somebody who met a Tibetan monk who was in a labour camp for many years in Tibet under the Chinese. And he was asked whether he felt frightened, you know, frightened of dying, of being killed. And he said, yes, some days I did feel very frightened. And what I was most frightened of that was that I would lose bodhicitta. And what he meant by that was losing the compassionate, loving aspiration to enlightenment. In other words, that he would feel hatred for his guards and the oppression that he was under. That's what he was frightened of. He wasn't frightened of losing his life. He wasn't frightened of pain. He was frightened of giving in to thoughts of retaliation, of anger and hatred. Interestingly enough, I read those verses on mind. The next verses that come immediately after that the Buddha says go like this. Those who entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. Those who do not entertain such thoughts as he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will still their hatred. Not by hatreds are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law, the eternal Dharma. So we give up Buddhism, we give up the Dharma if we retaliate, if we respond in that way to others, regardless of the provocation. Very challenging teaching this. Thirdly, we don't give up the Dharma out of fear. This means not being intimidated into giving it up. Gampopa says, supposing someone orders 300 soldiers daily to cut 5 ounces of your flesh, unless you give up the Dharma, you still don't give it up. You're not cowed, you're not intimidated, you can't be bullied in giving up your spiritual values. Again, this is very, very challenging indeed. And it really is a source of reflection. And we shouldn't assume that, oh yeah, I'd be fine, you know, if we were being intimidated in that way. This is the degree of individual spiritual connection with the Dharma we need to cultivate. Maybe we need to have a look at, in other situations, sort of softer situations, where we kind of suppress our values, our spiritual values, where we suppress our connection with the Dharma, it might because of fear of what others will say or think of us. You know, maybe we suppress our Buddhism around our family or our work colleagues or friends even,
friends who aren't into Buddhism, maybe because we're frightened. Well, that's very instructive. How deeply connected are we with the Dharma if we're doing that? Fourthly and finally, we don't give up the Dharma out of delusion. Gangchen Popa's discussion is very interesting. You might meet someone with a really great intellect, fantastic intellect, very eloquent, great in argument, and they prove conclusively in debate, in discussion, that there's no such thing as cause and effect. There's no such thing as morality. There's no such thing as the three jewels. There's no such thing as a higher spiritual life. And they just demolish all your arguments. You still don't give up the Dharma. You might not be able to explain the Dharma to them and explain why you live it. But you know it directly. You know it deeply. You taste it, if you like. There's a lovely story of Gampopa's teacher, Milarepa, the great yogi meditator Milarepa. Well, Milarepa knew his Dharma very, very well. But he wasn't a scholar. He wasn't a great intellectual. He wasn't a debater. But one day he was challenged to a debate by a scholarly monk who wanted to sort of put this itinerant vagabond yogi firmly in his place. And Milarepa lost the debate according to the rules of logic. I mean, he was sort of pretty hopeless at it. He just lost the debate. And this really upset Milarepa's disciple, Rechumpa. He was the other main disciple of Milarepa. Gampopa was the straightforward one. Rechumpa was, in a way, the complicated one. And he was really disappointed, you know, that, you know, sort of guru had let him down. He's a bit like your dad, you know, doesn't sort of, isn't better than the other dads. So Milarepa lost. But Milarepa just didn't care. He just sort of laughed. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I'm not bothered. All that matters is not debate. All that matters is living the Dharma, tasting the Dharma. So if you have such well-developed, such deep Shraddha, this quality of faith and confidence and trust in the Dharma, such a man, says Gampopa, is an excellent vessel of ultimate good. An excellent vessel of ultimate good. You really do have the most excellent working basis for attaining enlightenment. And Gampopa quotes a Buddhist text that says, when you have such faith, such Shraddha, Buddhas, enlightened ones, will come near to you. They'll come and teach you. When we realize that we possess the most precious human life, when we recognize that we possess freedoms and riches, when we awaken our faith, then we can really meet with spiritual friends. And that's the subject of tomorrow's talk, meeting spiritual friends.